Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a new case study recording with Dr. Kate. If you've been listening to them in 2018, you know that I started a new program where I cover a neurotransmitter case once a month. And a lot of the times these neurotransmitter cases are covered with additional tests that can complement the total comprehensive picture for each patient. And today I am so excited that we have a guest speaker, Dr. Allison McAllister, one of my colleagues. She's a clinical consultant manager at DRT. If you've called us before, chances are you've spoken on the phone to her or listened to a webinar that she's done or read some of her blogs. She is awesome, and I'm really excited that she will be talking about Zoe today. Go ahead, Dr. McAllister.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. We're going to talk about Zoe today. She's case number 9, and these will be recorded as well for you. But this is an intersection between neurotransmitters and urinary metabolites and diurnal stress hormones and cortisol hormones. So we're going to go through her test results and come up with some treatment plans and things to think about as well. So Zoe was 21 years old with irregular cycles. She had some mild symptoms, and we're going to talk about those, but the metabolic syndromes and high androgens were sort of her group. Her severe symptoms were the cortisol, basically adrenal issues, low metabolism, some androgen symptoms in terms of low libido specifically, dominance, estrogen, progesterone, and she is very notably on the Mirena IUD, and that is going to be important when we start looking at her lab results as well. You can see as she filled out her form here that there's a lot of bars to the side. In particular, foggy thinking, sleep disturbances, fatigue are some of her biggest ones, some nervousness, anxiety. And if we break those into mild, moderate, and severe, you can see that a lot of her severe symptoms are actually around stress and sleep, and then spilling over into anxiety, foggy thinking, some sugar cravings, libido issues, still having some cold body temperature headaches, and we're going to kind of look at some of those results as well. When we look at her neurotransmitter results, I think it's important to know that we really want people to be within the optimal range, or at least I really want people to be within the optimal range, so that when we start looking at outside of the optimal range in the broader range, those are my high normals and low normals, and then if they're purely outside all of the ranges, those are the highs. The optimal range is the 20th to 80th percentile, and so you'll get a better clinical result if you actually look within those. So we're going to kind of go through this and breaking it into different sections. This is the way I like to do it with my patients, and when I walk people through these, is to look at how they go in sort of groupings, and that's what we're going to do here today. But you can see that we've got some very obvious highs and lows, but when we look more subtly, we're going to actually see that, you know, if you look at serotonin, that it's high normal, and you look at GABA, it's within range, but if you look at glutamate, it's another one that's high normal. So I like to do this when I'm looking at these neurotransmitter reports, and I'll actually take that cascade sheet out and write on it for patients and draw little arrows. And I think it's really helpful in learning about these cases and evaluating them, but also in teaching your patients, which as a teaching tool, patients are very visual as well. And so it's really helpful to kind of see this. And we can see her high normal serotonin here with the arrow, and that is expected to give anxiety and restlessness. At its worst case, like when you get really high serotonin, you can get into flushing. It's a not sweating flush. You can get heart palpitations. You can get gut inflammation and diarrhea, and that's kind of a classic one. But we want to look at sort of serotonin, and we're going to look at her melatonin here in a little bit. But her levels are high normal. And we can see that that's coming from 5-HTP down to 5-HIAA and over to melatonin. When we look at her melatonin levels, look, she's such a mixed picture, and she was not taking melatonin, but she... When we're looking at urine, it's important to note that the urine ends the time point. So when we look at a morning collection, that first dot, it's actually a reflection of what she did overnight. And then sort of her afternoon is actually reflective of her morning hours or her second morning urine there. Her evening is actually reflective of her afternoon. So everything's looking backwards about 4 or 5 hours or since the last time you peed. So in her first morning collection during the night, she actually manages to have a very robust melatonin level once she is asleep. But if we look at her last sample there as she's going to bed, reflective of her evening hours, she's actually low. So she's not making very much melatonin going into sleep, but when she is asleep, she goes ahead and produces robust melatonin. This still can give you sleep problems. Usually people problems with going to sleep, once they are asleep, they usually sleep okay. We're going to see part of her other parts of sleep that really break down. But, you know, could she benefit from using melatonin? Maybe. She might just really need to look at what light she's using in her house, the brightness of computers and tablets and phones and screens that really break down melatonin. You could use blue glasses and things like that to shade those. Or small amounts of melatonin might be helpful for her. When we look at the next part of her neurotransmitters, we can see that glutamate is high, especially in relation to GABA and glutamine. If you look at glutamate, notice how B6 is what converts it to GABA. And glutamate, when I'm talking to providers, I always use the analogy of a spark. You know, you don't want to be on fire. That's too much, which she is. But you want to have something there. If you're too low, you know, your brain's not going to be making connections and excitatory. When it's too high, it makes too many connections. Things are happening too fast. It's the go, go, go neurotransmitter. So this is anxiety and impulsivity, OCD panic attacks, sleep disturbances, because basically the brain is rushing around too much. And so we need to balance that out. And you can see when we look at the cofactors nutrient-wise and enzymes, we can see that magnesium and manganese, glutathione are all part of the system of taking glutamate away from glutamate and into GABA and glutamine. When we look at the next part of our neurotransmitters kind of as a group, we're going to look at glycine, histamine, and PEA. We're going to look at those because they are a little bit of a family, and I'm going to point those out to you in a minute. But glycine, you can see right there, is really high. And most people know about glycine as being helpful for anxiety, but it actually can be associated with anxiety as the body's basically requiring a lot of B6 and needing more B6. Both to methylate out the glycine. You can also see really high histamine, and just like allergies, that can be from allergies, that can be environmental allergies, that can be dysbiosis, that can be from histamine foods. And high histamine is commonly associated with sleep disturbances, but also headaches, allergies, mastocytosis, those kind of things, depression. And you can see PEA, and PEA is also really high. PEA is one that her level was high normal, but most people live in PEA really within the 20th to 80th percentile, really around 30th percentile. Like, they usually have levels of 8. So when it's high normal, it usually causes symptomatic symptoms. And the biggest one I see is anxiety a lot, impulsivity and anxiety, panic attacks. Oftentimes is associated with PEA. So these are ones, we've got a lot of excitatory neurotransmitters happening here that are really putting her brain on edge. In terms of sleep, you're not going to be getting a lot of restful sleep because your mind's kind of going whirling around. What do they have in common? Look at how the last part of each of those enzymes names starts with MT. Those stands for methyltransferase, and that means they need methyl groups in order to work that enzyme. So these are all a family by methylation and their demand for methylation. You can also see that SAMe is required for both histamine and PEA. You can see B6 in numerous ones of these pathways. So this is all sort of a pathway of methylation. And the methyltransferase group commonly will be high if people have problems with methylation. When we look at the catecholamines and the metabolites, this is on our sheet. This is in the lower left-hand corner. We can see that high PEA, but then look at the lower whole portion of this, dopamine, norepinephrine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all of that is so low. She does go downstream. So downstream from those, we actually have maybe even increased enzyme activity pushing towards HVA and VMA, almost like our MAO enzymes are working too quickly or our COMT enzymes are working too quickly. And that may be a genetic SNP, but the problem is that what really impacts our brain is the dopamine and norepinephrine and epinephrine. So when those are too low, you get the fatigue and sleep disturbances and lack of joy. Lower dopamine make people try to look for excitement, look for a reward because nothing's really joyful. When you combine that with a low norepinephrine and epinephrine, you will commonly get a picture of apathy. Someone who really, nothing's really exciting, nothing really gets them off the couch. It's really hard to get moving. So you combine this with a high PEA. You have someone who may be sitting at home on the couch having panic attacks and anxious about something, but isn't actually necessarily doing anything. When we look at Zoe's adrenal picture, you can see that in the, once again, the urine and the time point, we can see that her morning level is actually okay. It looks a little bit on the lower side here, but remember, she woke up a little bit late here, so everything's a little skewed to the side. If we kind of have to visually move it back into our more typical 7 o'clock awakening, we would see that she'd be okay in the morning. And even second morning would be okay, but she's still elevated in the evening time and bedtime. So those are graphed on an actual 24-hour clock of her collection. So she's running really high cortisols during the day. So we have to ask her, what is she doing? You know, cortisol's job is to respond to stress, mental, emotional, and physical. That's its job. Blood sugar is one of its biggest jobs is to maintain. Where is this coming from? Now, this test is something that's unique to ZRT, but it's one I particularly find valuable for these people where they have so many symptoms of adrenal insufficiency, and you're like, but they have all this cortisol, but they feel so tired. They're exhausted all the time. Look at where her norepinephrine and epinephrine is. These are both coming from the medulla of the adrenal glands. When we measure urinary norepinephrine, it's really reflective of her sympathetic nervous system. When we measure urinary epinephrine, it's really reflective of that medulla adrenal gland. And we can see she's just super low. So she could have problems with blood pressure regulation. She could just be tired and just not having responses. So high anxiety, sleep problems, right? You can't go to sleep. Your quality of sleep is poor when you're running higher cortisols, but lower norepinephrine, just decreased mental sharpness, forgetful, depression, fatigue. And I would say fatigue should probably be highlighted and with five, go ahead and put 5 exclamation points after it because that's usually what we really see with those super low levels. But you also want to think autonomic stuff with that. Sometimes we've seen people whose blood pressure or heart rate can really vary with these two. When we look at her urinary metabolites, it's very important to remember that she's on a Mirena. 25% of women on a Mirena will not have a period at all. So for them to decide when to test might be a challenge. They may not have any period. They may have no idea when their cycle is. So we always have to keep that with a grain of thought. She's a young woman. You know, she's not menopausal. So the low estrogen, low progesterone may really be that she is low in those hormones, but it also may be that she collected really more in the follicular phase of her menstrual cycle, which is likely. ZRT has a luteal phase. We don't have a follicular phase here. So my guess is that that's really what happened with her estrogen and progesterone during this collection. But what we can see here, and based on her symptoms we want to look at, is look how high her DHEA is. And that will not be changing. She's not on DHEA therapy, and her levels are 5 times normal. That's really important to know. It has 2 causes. Maybe 3. DHEA is a response from ACTH. So if you're super stressed out, DHEA and cortisol will both go up. High DHEA can also be driven by high insulin. It is commonly high in women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which I think we have to question for Zoe here based on her symptoms, actually more than this individual lab, but her symptoms. It's also associated with someone who is an athlete. People who exercise and have a lot of muscle mass will tend to keep higher DHEA levels. But high DHEA is an androgen, and it absolutely will contribute to acne, facial body hair, loss of scalp hair, independently from testosterone. Now, the good news is if we go down to her DHT, which is just second from the bottom here, right here, we can see she does not have a lot of DHT. In fact, she's low normal. This may be contributing to some of her symptoms of low libido, that she actually is on the edge of low. And so if we have this very mixed picture of someone who's on levonorgestrel, which is IUD that has some androgenic properties to it or androgenic tendencies in that progestin. So some of her high androgen symptoms may be due to the progestin IUD. Some are probably due to this higher DHEA. And then we have some deficiency symptoms that may have to do with her DHT levels as her testosterone level is basically kept at that lower end. And that may be, you know, that may to some degree be impacted by her IUD. We definitely see progesterone impacted by the IUD, not necessarily testosterone. So we have someone who has lots of sleep, lots of sugar cravings and nervous and depression. We have a lot of mixed hormonal pictures with high cortisols and this mixed melatonin picture, and then low norepinephrine. And then neurotransmitter-wise, we have a picture of someone with a little bit high serotonin, but glycine and histamine PEA, you know, quite high, and then this deficiency of dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. So what do we want to do for her? Well, first of all, we want to talk about sleep hygiene. She makes melatonin once asleep. We know that about Zoe. So we want to focus on her use of tablets and lights in her house. I have some concerns about some of the new LED lights, that those might actually really be better at breaking down melatonin, which is not better for us, but better at doing that. So looking at lower light levels, having, you know, cutoff times in that hour before bed where there's no screen time, that reading before bed, those can all make a difference in terms of inducing melatonin levels. And also, if you combine that with mindfulness, bringing down her cortisol, which we want to do at nighttime, so that not only is she inducing sleep, but the quality of that sleep during the night is actually more restful. There's also important, mindfulness has been used to try to adjust the autonomic nervous system in terms of epinephrine and norepinephrine. So there's a lot of information now about norepinephrine and mindfulness, usually in terms of lowering norepinephrine, which people are sort of that sympathetic nervous system tone too much. But I think we have to be honest that the only reason you end up being so low is because you've been high for a long time. So I think that mindfulness still can be helpful. A low histamine diet. Histamine intolerance in food is really a funny diet. Some of the foods are fine fresh, but the moment you put them in your, you know, refrigerator for a while, they no longer are good. So patients are often the ones that discover that histamine intolerance is their deal. They just start snooping around, like trying to figure out why they can eat this fresh but not canned or not in the refrigerator. But it's one that can be really powerful, and it's one that I'll often give to patients and just say, you know, you might look at it, because it's just a weird group of foods, a lot of preserved foods, but it's also kind of an odd group that don't seem to have any correlation. In terms of yoga, I think yoga can be particularly good as part of mindfulness and getting our body to stretch, but weightlifting. And the reason I put weightlifting in there is because she has some symptoms of metabolic syndrome. And she has some symptoms of PCOS, and there's more and more information that lifting weights intensely, so doing really hard weights for like 5 minutes, 7 minutes, can actually give you the benefit of more moderate cardiovascular profile, but be a little bit easier on the norepinephrine cortisol picture of things. And I think that that's a nice mix. It's also really good for women with PCOS because it increases muscle mass, decreases insulin sensitivity, but doesn't start triggering hunger, which is oftentimes something with PCOS that women will really drive. So that can be a good one. I think that reevaluating her Mirena IUD might also be helpful for her, just because it has some androgenic properties. On the other hand, you know, we could have bleeding issues and things like that, and this could be sort of the better of all of her choices. Foundationally, you know, as far as nutrients go, magnesium is really key for being a cork on glutamate. Magnesium helps moderate glutamate release, so it can be really helpful. It's also really helpful for a lot of muscle spasms and sleep in general, so it's one of my favorites. We already know with her high glycine and with her methylation issues that B6 might be really needed for her. So looking at high B6, and there's actually a whole link to B6 deficiency showing up symptomatically as high anxiety once starting birth control pills. So that's actually kind of a marker for B6 and actually zinc as well deficiency. So looking at B6, it's really easy to get deficient. Methyl tetrahydrofolate or activated folic acid, we know as we've infused every food with folic acid that 40% of the population actually can't use it very well. So using a methylated form of tetrahydrofolate in with a B vitamin complex that has the B6 or by itself can be really helpful, or just in a group with the methyl donors. Commonly, they kind of all go together, and it's not uncommon to sort of see a great product that combines all of those. Inositol works on receptors. The dosage is 4 grams per day. I put that down because a lot of people try to do this in capsules, and really you just want to do it in the powder. It tastes good, so it's really easy to do. And a lot of my patients like to do half in the morning and half at night. But inositol works on receptors. I was going to do a webinar once on all the receptors that use inositol, but then I found out it's like 380 receptors, and so I'm not going to do that presentation anymore. It's used for everything. It's really a basic for getting receptors to work in. It's been used for anxiety for a long time. It's also now been used for PCOS, and people will say, well, what's the difference? Well, a lot of women, if Zoe here has PCOS, have 60% have mental emotional issues, and it's thought to be because the receptors don't work well. So inositol helps blood sugar, helps anxiety. I think for her, it's a really nice one to be added in. She could just even do it all at bedtime. Works fine. NAC and alpha-lipoic acid are two of our building blocks for glutathione. And when we have a situation where we're trying to lower glutamate, deal with high glutamate, deal with high glycine, things that are antioxidants, as well as things that lower histamine, which NAC at least is a mucolytic, can be really, really helpful for lowering those. They're very easy to take. They don't tend to cause a lot of, you know, other side effects. As far as that goes, it can help with fatty liver if you've got PCOS. So those are some great supplements to really look at for this picture. In terms of the adrenal support, she's this mixed picture, right? She's fine sometimes and she's really high. So she's really one person that you want to look at for the adrenal adaptogens. She's got this medulla that's not working so well and this cortex that is. So you can use beastie bits, as I refer to them, glandulars. They might be helpful for her. But adrenal adaptogens, I think, are going to be great. Ashwagandha is one of my favorites because it also ties into blood sugar balance. So I think for her, with her hypometabolism symptoms, would tie in very nicely. Same with holy basil. But using a little phosphatidylserine to drop that cortisol at nighttime might be really helpful for her. And one of the things that phosphatidylserine does at bedtime, when you lower that cortisol, is you get a deeper sleep. So if you can get to sleep, but your sleep is shallow, people usually will sleep 3 hours and then wake up. It's really annoying. So if they can get to sleep, but then the phosphatidylserine can drop their cortisol to a much deeper sleep, what happens is they can transition through their sleep cycles and don't wake up, you know, 2 or 3 hours later and then up for several hours. As far as neurotransmitter support, a lot of these things are obviously going to impact neurotransmitters, but specifically for her, because the anxiety is such a big picture, I think of L-theanine. L-theanine is sort of the adaptogen of all of the neurotransmitters. That's how I think about it. It's, if you're high, it's perfect. If you're low, it's perfect. And that's because it's really working on regulation of release and receptor feedback, so it's really a nice one for that. But looking at tyrosine, because she's low in dopamine, not at first, but as sort of a secondary, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks into a program, that might be a nice one because, remember, her dopamine is low. Her everything that goes down that cascade is super low. I also think about adding lithium orotate. We all know prescription lithium, but food-grade lithium can really help regulate that PEA and that panic attack picture. So that's actually a super nice one to kind of bring on board because symptomatically people notice that one pretty quickly. And dosages there are anywhere from 5 milligrams up to 40 milligrams or so. Vitamin C, when you look at those cascades, actually comes up numerous places. It's also needed to make cortisol. And I think it's just a good one to remember. It's a very basic nutrient. It's very inexpensive, but it can really help motivate or modulate a lot of these neurotransmitters just by part of their cascade and moving them through the cascade, but also in terms of the adrenal. So it's just an easy one. I should have probably put fish oil on here as well for the same reason. And then quercetin. I think of quercetin because the histamine can be such a problem. Quercetin is a super nice one. It's really relatively inexpensive, but it can be really stabilizing for that. And it's a nice rescue if people are doing like a low histamine diet. They can go ahead and sort of rescue themselves if they accidentally eat a food by doing high-dose vitamin C and quercetin. So we kind of want to balance everything out, but there's a lot of mixed price points here for people. And it wouldn't, you know, obviously wouldn't do all of these things at once, but there's actually a lot of products you could get that could blend a number of these together. So I think it can be really helpful.
Thank you, Dr. McAllister. Stay tuned for next month's recording. And I hope you enjoyed this webinar by Dr. McAllister as much as I did.